This will be.
This score should have been way worse.
Way, way worse.
Way worse.
You know what? Screw it. We're an OUA podcast. Let's start with Western defense.
Bonjour et bienvenue à le 5 en 5, votre maison pour le football de la OUA.
That's about as far as it'll go. Hello and welcome back to 55, your home for OUA football. Me and Tom are back on the mics in the wake of the 110th Grey Cup. Congratulations to the Montreal Alouettes. And of course, following the two bowl games that we had this weekend, that certainly left us a bit wanting. In some ways, the Grey Cup was a nice way to bounce back off of that, despite our feelings regarding the Grey Cup happening a week before the Vanier Cup. But we've spoken on that before, no doubt a conversation for another pod, but a weekend chock full of Canadian football. Tom, my friend, how the heck are you doing?
Salut, mon ami. Ça va très bien.
That Duolingo's paying off, brother.
I'm doing well. It is a hell of a time to be a Francophone football fan. I'll tell you that, with your Alouettes taking the Grey Cup and the Carabin going back to a Vanier Cup. So hell of a time there. And exactly like you said, you and I got together for both of these U-Sports games. It was lovely being over at your house. You are a very gracious host, and your father is incredible. We wanted so much more from both of these games, really. We wanted more. And so to have that satisfying conclusion in the Grey Cup with a phenomenal game was a nice little point to the weekend.
Yeah, I don't know if we had hit the halftime of the first game between Western and Montreal, where I had to break out the whiteboard and me and Tom are just sitting on the couch going over run blocking schemes and like, well, how do you do power? Oh, and how do you do your trap and outside zone stuff? And that was honestly perhaps my favorite part of the day, in addition to, yeah, just having you over with the old man and just a great weekend of celebrating football. So if you read the title of the podcast, we are going to combine the review of the UTEC and the Mitchell Bowls, and then it just feels natural that we just go into the setup of it. I feel like most of the discourse that we would have about Montreal and UBC will take place in breaking down those two games. Like always, we'll do our players of the week, of course, with a much more extra OUA view of things, just given, well, how things broke down this weekend. But before we get there, my brain always turns to mashed potatoes when I hit record here, Tom. Were we starting there, or are we going to go on some of the other little things we wanted to talk on?
Well, I think we should start off with the fact that while you and I started with our very limited French on this podcast here to celebrate the fact of the Francophones and everything that they're doing in football in Canada, the other side of that was to also talk a little bit about the Grey Cup. And one Marc-Antoine Ducroix and his passionate speech that he had at the end of the Grey Cup for his French viewers. For those of you who don't know, who didn't have a chance to see the pregame show or whatever else, when the CFL Grey Cup was getting set up in Hamilton at Tim Hortons Field, right in my backyard, they did not have anything calling out LCF or any of the French Canadian posters, marketing materials, whatever it was in the stadium. It was obviously some kind of an oversight right before the actual day happened. They were able to get up some stuff, but it was obviously very last minute. And so that was a big point of contention. And like, yeah, he spoke his mind. It was an awesome speech because it fired me up to hear all the passion that he kind of brought to this. But I wanted to make sure that we brought that up here because I think that is a big point to talk about with the CFL.
Yeah, and I wasn't aware of this situation until you sent me the video. Once again, I mean, I was ready to run through a brick wall just watching Marc-Antoine Ducroix. I mean, the interview he did in English is on TSN alone, and really everyone they interviewed on Montreal, you know, I'm an Argos fan, so it hurt a little bit, but obviously a great underdog story is hard not to root for, and obviously just with such a great game that it was, it was pretty spectacular. So I wasn't actually privy to the story until, like, I don't know, 10 minutes ago at the time of recording, obviously. Really two questions came to mind for me, because I don't know, I'm still kind of processing it all. What I don't understand is – because he had mentioned something in there about on TSN, they were talking about the Argos and the Blue Bombers and everything like that. Was it a function? Here's so the oversight, which is probably a polite way of framing it, but it probably is also just what it was. Well, maybe, because here's my questions. One, was the French labeling and just identification and markers, LCF, all that, not put in just because like somebody, it was somebody's job to do so and they just dropped the ball on it, completely forgot? Or was it not done specifically because of what a upset it would have been and was when Montreal that went on to beat Toronto to make it, that the people setting up Tim Hortons Field were trying to get a leg up on it, anticipating it to be the Argos, and then didn't feel the necessity to put up the French markers? And frankly, I'm not sure which one's more offensive, if you will, because if it's a product of them only thinking, well, number one, disrespectful to the Alouettes and assuming they were going to lose to the Argos in that latter example, to for them to sort of jump the gun, if you will. But then also that somewhat implies that the powers that be would have only decorated Tim Hortons Field with French, you know, pageantry and whatnot if Montreal was in it, right? Because that's a bad look, because you would still, you know, it's the Canadian Football League. You're still going to hope that French viewers are going to be tuning in, that there's perhaps going to be some Francophones making the trip to Hamilton. Maybe someone's on business, whatever it might be, or someone who just lives in Hamilton but was born and raised in Quebec. So that's a bad look. And is that worse, better than the first option of just that someone completely just forgot, irrespective of whether Montreal made it or not, that someone was like, oh my goodness, I only put up the English signs. So that's all I've really been able to make of it in the now, I guess, 15 minutes since you told me about this story. I don't know. What do you think? You've had more time to process this.
Yeah, I think regardless of how you look at it, it's pretty unacceptable. I mean, even if you're coming from a standpoint of, well, you know, we had assumed it was going to be Toronto against Winnipeg and whatever. Quebec is still a part of Canada. Regardless of what you think and the larger picture and everything else of what's been happening over the years and that conversation, they are still a part of Canada. Those are Canadians over there that speak French. And if we want to truly grow our game, like the CFL continues to say, you have to include every Canadian, you know? So it's a huge oversight there. And it's a little bit embarrassing to say that we did something like that, or we forgot about our own people in that regard. And I know certainly in the English culture, it's a very common thing to kind of crap on the French and do whatever. And I think I've myself have done that a lot out of spite, because I could have possibly had 3 Vanier Cup rings, but because of the French, I do not. Regardless, those are phenomenal players. They're phenomenal people. They are Canadians first and foremost here. We should be making the effort to make sure that everyone feels welcome in our game and they feel represented in that spot. Marc-Antoine Ducroix, like, absolutely valid in everything that he said there. And a lot of that frustration in the video that he showed is because of the atmosphere and the feelings that both sides kind of have here. So, while yes, there's a larger story within that entire kind of relationship between English and French in Canada here, at the very least, you need to have that representation in the CFL. And it was disappointing to hear that had been the case in this one.
Yeah, and I guess the last thing I'll say on it is just like it's not even like a nod. It's not even like doing something to be like it's a national language. That's like, so it's whether we want to use that word, oversight, right. Or whatever it is. It's it's a national language. You are the national, like the Canadian Football League is of course the football league of this nation. Right. So, just from that standpoint, going back to the idea of oversight, and I think, yeah, you said it's a bit of a bit embarrassing, I don't know. Maybe more stuff will come to light about this. I'll be interested to follow the story a little bit more. But yeah, very, very spicy. Of course, emotions were running very high on that team. Because I mean, you know, hey, we're going to be talking about some Can West football in a moment. You know, shout out to young Mr. Philpott catching that touchdown the game winner. And then of course, just, you know, the nature of how that game ended, the underdog story, everything that, you know, hey, most people thought about Montreal this year. And for them to win it, like, emotions were high after that game, and rightfully so. And then you add in that element, and it's just, yeah, it was only natural that was going to happen. So good on him for speaking on it. You know, once again, whatever you think of the matter, good on him for speaking on it. One other piece of U Sport and actually OUA news we want to touch on. Tom, I'll give you the floor on this one again. And you brought this up in our little pre-pod meeting as something that is worth noting. And as always, you're right to note that this is, you know, U Sport and, of course, more specifically, OUA news. And it's our duty to have some kind of discussion of it, though we know we will have a much more prolonged discussion about this in the off season. It feels, though, just of all the seasons York's had over the years, it feels so wrong for us to talk about the York Lions in the episode that we're going to break down the UTEC and Mitchell Bowl and set up the Vanier Cup. But here we are doing it anyways. Tom, what's the news?
Yeah, it certainly feels a little strange. I don't think we've ever talked about York this late into a season, but the York Lions have officially announced that they are going to start their national head coach search soon. They announced this on Instagram. It was retweeted, reshared by their athletics director, and people had some things to say in those comments. Rightfully so. This program has, in the best way that I possibly could say it, had some struggles. And so you really need to make sure that you're finding the right person here. And, like, at least they're doing it now and they're announcing it now so that they can hopefully have this process in and done by early next year and have a full year of recruiting to try and gain some more people into that squad. But, like, This is day one. Hopefully, this is a new day for the York Lions, because certainly it cannot get any worse than what we saw this year.
The whole piece on, like, they're officially starting their search, like, we teased them for the fact that they only started looking for their head coach after Craney ceased to be there anymore. Whatever, yeah. You know, whatever they want to tell you that story is all about. But it was, like, officially in February where they, like, started their search. So at the very least, it's like, isn't the head's coaching search, at least, is, if we're being, like, fair, isn't it continuing? Isn't that truly what's going on? You didn't have a head coach last year. You had, you know, your, I don't know how they framed it, I guess.
They said two head coaches.
They called it two head coaches. Okay. And you know what? Like, I'm not going to assume that couldn't necessarily work. I know you were much more bullish on being like that you need that singular voice and everything like that, whether it's associate head coaches and anything like that. I don't know. That's it. We'll talk about this more later. What do you think?
Yeah, I think first off, I just wanted to, you know, make sure that we spoke about it, because it's like, well, yeah, this is something that you should have been doing for a little while now. But more importantly, this is not something that I think we're just going to glaze over. Like, if anything, this is going to be an entire podcast and probably like an hour and a half to 2 hour long podcast on the York Lions, the situation and everything else with some experts involved in this. But they're starting. They're at the starting point.
You know what? Honestly, this is just straight up rude of York. This is like, I wasn't one to levy this criticism, but after, I always go to the NBA, after the Denver Nuggets knocked out the LA Lakers, they're interviewing LeBron in the locker room, and he makes some kind of a statement about that maybe this is it for him, maybe he's going to retire, and everyone started to be like, oh, he's trying to steal the thunder from the Denver Nuggets having swept them, the Nuggets are going to the NBA Finals and all this stuff, like, you could have saved that for later. Not that that was my I didn't make that comment myself. I am going to make this about the York Lions. So, like, save this post. Like, you know what? Like, this is not like we're fresh off the Grey Cup. We have what looks like a heck of a Vanier Cup on the cusp happening in Kingston. You know what? Like, spare us having to like put 2 cents as York. Nah. Okay. Here we go. Mitchell Bowl, UTEC Bowl, national semifinals recap. As we do, let's start with some hardware. I guess this is the first time we are handing out, spoiler alert, all of our awards to non-OUA recipients. And frankly, all of these feel pretty darn obvious. On the offensive side of the ball, Tom, where are we going?
You know, you look at the performance that everybody had in these games here, and surprisingly in all games, all three of the four quarterbacks really struggled, or at least had some struggles, except for one in Garrett Rooker. 22 for 26, 303 yards, 4 touchdowns, no picks. This kid looks special. I really loved everything that I saw from UBC and this offense going up against the State FX squad. I was a little disappointed to like the effort from State FX, but we'll get into that. But certainly Rooker played his butt off, and he deserves the Offensive Player of the Week.
Yeah, I obviously don't have the familiarity that you already had with him, and I know even for you it's not as in-depth as our OUA guys, but man – and as you said, we'll talk about it later. There was a lot of things where you're watching that offense and you're like, this feels like a pro offense, the way that they, the way he gets the ball. That was special. Let's move to our earlier game to look at the defensive side of the ball, because I mean, hey, in a game where you have, golly, what was the total on it? 6 turnovers in a game. I think you're going to have to take a Defensive Player of the Week nomination. Of course, we're talking about the Montreal Carabin. And, you know, we just went on our little tirade. Well, not tirade, but we just went on our little piece recognizing just what a somewhat tumultuous moment it was for French Canadian football fans. And I feel bad because I'm not sure if it's Nicolas Roy or Nicolas Roy. But nonetheless, however you say it, he put on a show against the Western Mustangs at home. You know, anytime you're going to rack up a sack, 1.5 tackles for loss, a fumble recovery and an interception. He was all over the ball. And, you know, we'll talk about it more. I mean, just the how Hillock, you know, the game he had and how Montreal seemingly made him, it looked like he was uncomfortable. And Roy / maybe Roy certainly played a major part in that.
Absolutely. Yeah, he had a phenomenal game. And even despite the fact of the awesome stats that gets called out here, the game and the real presence that he had wasn't on these stats. He was constantly in the face of Evan, making sure that he was uncomfortable the entire time. He was disrupting the run game. He was just getting in the way of everything that Western wanted to do seemingly on offense, and really just showcased the value that he brings to this Carabin defense. It was impressive to watch.
Special teams, we've talked about them before. If anything, this is our OUA shout-out because, as we mentioned on a few pods now, not only is he an Ontario kid, I believe hailing from the Ottawa region, if memory serves, but he spent time on both the Queens Golden Gales and the Carleton Ravens before making his way out west. Special teams player of the week, Tom Sterling.
Here in Flannery Fleck.
Yeah, buddy.
3 for 4 on his field goals, 5 for 5 on extra points. 5 punts, one of them inside of the 20. He was just on fire for UBC. He played really, really well.
That's all. That's your players of the week. Let's dive in to the action. We'll start with the early game, which of course was the UTEC Bowl. Final score in this game, the Montreal Carabin 29-29. The Western Mustangs 1-2-3. 29-3. Tom, you know, it was funny, like, you know, we're watching this with my dad, and you know, I think he had made the comment at some point of like when's the last time like we've seen Western lose a game quite that bad, and it's certainly in many ways the game that I did call to mind, which may or may not have been at the hands of our Guelph Griffins in 2014 in an OUA semifinal game. I don't think I've ever seen them lose a game quite like this. I'm inclined, like, I want to talk about Western's defense still, because mm-hmm. in so many ways, this will be...
This score should have been way worse.
Way, way worse.
Way worse.
You know what? Screw it. We're an OUA podcast. Let's start with Western's defense. That's 29 points on them. But yeah, like, go ahead, Tom. Like, this was just, so incredible when you really think about it in the grand scheme of things.
Absolutely. When you and I first started watching this game and we see Jonathan Senecal, now obviously Greg Marshall had his words that he spoke about. He likened Jonathan like a Trey Ford. And I think that's an accurate depiction mm-hmm. of this young man. His ability to get outside of the pocket and to make plays were unbelievable. I think you and I were talking. He rolls out to his left, fakes out a couple of Western defenders, sets his feet, and throws a dime down the field as if he was in the pocket throwing something completely naturally. It was really outstanding to see. And the Western defense still did their thing, forcing Jonathan Senecal to throw two interceptions in this game here. You know, I was really impressed with a lot of the play. You and I had been talking about for a little while, but Jackson Finley coming up big for them, and with an amazing interception and constantly all over the receivers that were catching the balls. But he really had a great game. Five total tackles for them. They were just constantly put in bad situations or situations where they felt like they had to kind of come out and they had to do, you know, they had to make up for the offense and the lackluster performances and the turnovers that were constantly seemingly happening here. The one thing that I will say, and I think finally kind of bit them in the butt, is the lack of a pass rush finally caught up to Western here. Jonathan Senecal, while rolling out and obviously doing his thing, really did not have to deal with a lot of pressure. And the pressure, when it did come, oftentimes came from blitzing or came from other things. And that puts Western at something of a disadvantage, that even with all of that, they still played phenomenally. Don't get me wrong, I'm not likening this loss to their lack of pass rush, but it was something that I thought was apparent watching this game.
Yeah, it was, you know, what was interesting, and I'll say briefly on Senecal, and then I do want to go back to the defense and the kind of part and parcel, was that, like, frankly, in some ways, and this is once again goes to why I wanted to start with Western's defense, in some ways, I was blown away because you could see the talent he had. And, you know, let's read the numbers. He goes 21 of 31 for 228. Only one touchdown, two interceptions. Of course, as you discussed, he is a dual threat quarterback in that traditional sense, only picking up 38 on the ground, but he does end up leading Montreal in the rushing category. So it obviously isn't the stat line you'd expect from a Het Crichton nominee, MVP out of the RSEQ, but so many of these, there were so many moments just watching the way he moves. Like, he is such a smooth runner, the way he can throw off platform. A few times we were commenting where he almost didn't do himself some favors, where he might have been able to set his feet, mm-hmm. might have missed on a couple balls here and there. But the talent was so darn apparent watching him, even though the outcome that he produced in this game wasn't there when you look at it, just sort of stat lines that he puts up, had been putting up all year long. Now, to your point on how Western was trying to create pressure, I think that's a great point you bring up about them not having a true pass rusher just on the D-line who can get after them. I would, it would be the privilege of all privileges to be able to sit down with Coach Gleason and actually get a sense, or really anyone on that defensive staff or just a player, have a sense of what their game plan was to attack Senecal. Because there were moments where it seemed like they may have had a rule where if he escapes the pocket, rolls out, there was a half auto fire at times, get him a little uncomfortable. And I almost felt like Western early on in the game, defensively, they were playing great, but there were some plays where they felt, and despite everything we've said about this being a team that often makes their way into these national semifinal games, they're almost always in Yates Cup, so high leverage games, where they looked maybe a bit overeager defensively, like times where, guys like Lawrence Bowers-Kane, Max Nixon, these linebackers who have been so sturdy for them all season long, almost, you know, attacking Senekal on the run, trying to really perhaps lay that big hit, set the tone. But a few times where these guys were whiffing, and it really felt like, though the defense still held up early, it was maybe into the second quarter and then pretty consistently beyond where they really just settled down and just kind of, you know, tried to create that pressure, tried to make him uncomfortable where they could, if you can, because he looks unflappable. And like, there was one point where you could just see, I forget what the play was, where he was, something had happened. I can't recall the play, but you could tell he's like smiling, he's joking around. And as soon as, you know, as soon as that's happening, like, that's just like, that's a dagger to the heart as a defensive player, anyone on that Western team, when it's like, oh my God, this guy is having fun while doing this too right now. But it felt like it took them a little bit to settle down, where maybe they were a little eager to be like, I want to be the guy to lay that boom hit stick on him, to really be like, no, 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 we came to play, our defense travels, and everything like that.
Yeah, most definitely. And, you know, it was something I came out and was making fun of the broadcaster for getting something wrong before realizing Max von Mühldorfer was out at defensive end for this game. He was not a defensive tackle. I believe they had Max out at one of the ends, Marcus Robinson and Malcolm Frazier at the D tackles, and I can't remember who the other defensive end was for them, but they're obviously trying to play around with their defense, which I thought was a little interesting as well, putting von Mühldorfer out there, because while credit to him, he actually rushed the passer decently well. I thought he moved outside. He moved as a defensive end pretty well from the snaps that I saw. He's obviously, like, this is his first time really at least starting and going into an entire game as a defensive end while wearing the purple. I thought it was a little interesting to go that route. Maybe they thought he was a little bit better at contain and trying to make sure that Senekal wasn't leaving the pocket as often as he was. But they were obviously taking a look at things, moving some personnel around and trying to do their thing. And once again, we talked about in the past couple of games here about the ability that they have to make adjustments at halftime. Montreal scores 24 points in the first half and then 5 the rest of the game. They completely shut down the offense and they go back to that Western style, like we've kind of, like, exactly like you said, of like, you know what? We don't need to send the kitchen sink at this guy. We can just sit back. We've got the guys in the back end that can play with the best of them here. Sure, is he going to get a little bit more time? Is that going to make things a lot more difficult? Absolutely. But they did their thing and they did it pretty damn well. So once again, phenomenal job by this Western defense making those adjustments and getting into halftime. But unfortunately, everything with the offense, it was just too little too late.
And, you know, the last thing we'll add in, I mean, just on the defensive side for Western, though, just to add in where, you know, as we said, not a big rushing team from Montreal, and it mostly is Senekal creating with his feet, but I still think a lot of credit deserved there, especially when he's such a threat to, you know, make strikes down the field, to scramble out, create off platform and everything like that, but to still be able to slow down the rush in the way they did, holding Montreal to under 98 yards. Not a massive rushing team, but we always talk about how the pass sets up the run and vice versa. When you have such a threat at pass, to be able to limit him in the way that they did, which all things considered, they certainly did, and still not be able, you know, it'd been one thing if they limited him, but it's like maybe Montreal rushed for a whole bunch or Senekal was getting a lot on the ground. Just once again, hats off to this defense, Jackson Finley and that whole squad. Just, obviously not the way they wanted to go out, but, you know, going out swinging in the most and as true to those words as you can. Oh man, we got to flip the script now and talk about Montreal's defense or Western's offense. And frankly, it's a bit of both, because obviously they're competing against each other. One's going to influence the other and vice versa. You, me, Nate, Jack, when he came on, so many of us, in the wake of all that garbledygook levied at the feet of Evan Hillock following their defeat to Laval last year in a game that was not an environment to pass in by any means, just purely based on the weather, a year in which Western hadn't taken the time in the season to develop their passing game in the way that they had this year, certainly as a product of not just historically recent history of them just being such a ground and pound team, but also with the OUA MVP in their backfield, Keon Edwards, of course. And for so many other reasons, we, you know, stood guard for Evan Hillock after that game. For all the naysayers who doubted him, literally a year off of him winning a Vanier Cup as a rookie and being named the offensive MVP. I haven't been checking what Twitter may be saying about him, and frankly, I don't want to know. Tom makes a face, so I'm sure it's not the nicest things out there. But this is a hard one to defend his performance. I give a lot of credit to Montreal, but this was a bad outing for Evan.
Yeah, this one was rough. Like you had said earlier on the pod here, six total turnovers by Western, all six at the hands of Western quarterbacks. Three interceptions from Evan, two fumbles, and one fumble from Jerome Rancourt on a quarterback sneak, which he has been doing all year long. And you know, that I think at that point you and I had kind of just thrown our hands up and were like, what the hell is going on with the Mustangs offense? The very first drive, you know, Western has, I think they had two first downs, and we were like, oh wow, like this looks really good. Like they look really solid. And Evan throws a pick in the first drive of the game. The first quarter of action for them starts off with a pick. They get the ball back, go two and out. I think the next drive, they get a couple of first downs, ultimately have to punt, and then another two and out, and the first quarter is done. And that's how Western starts things off here. And then afterwards has three of the remaining turnovers in the second quarter alone, which is why the fact that Montreal only scores 17 points in that quarter is the testament that we were talking about for this Western defense. Like they should have scored, like this game realistically probably should have been like 48-0. Like really, if that Western defense doesn't play as well as they did and stop the bleeding as best as they can, you know, this game could have been a whole lot uglier. But man, like it really didn't seem like anything was going right for Western in the offense here. It was a tough game to watch.
Yeah, to say the least. And once again, I you know, as we so constantly say, football's not played in a vacuum, right? Montreal, it felt like what Western did to Taylor Algrisma last week, and I guess 3 or 4 weeks ago, whenever it was that first outing they had. Though I guess Algrisma was pretty good in that week 9 matchup. But just the idea that, like, you talk about that first interception, he's under pressure, throws it into a crowd, just making him uncomfortable. And, Tom, you obviously mentioned in sort of one of the earlier segments when we were talking about some of the CFL stuff going on, your familiarity playing teams out of Quebec. We've talked about that previewing this episode. We've talked about that a lot before. I got to play Montreal twice, one in exhibition and one in a Mitchell Bowl myself. And specifically about Montreal, and obviously it's now, I guess, almost 10 years since either of us have played this team. But as we're watching, one of the comments that we had that seemed to reflect what we remembered playing them from nearly a decade ago, and I certainly don't know the personnel and the coaching staff well enough to be able to say, like, oh, yeah, that's, you know, coach so-and-so still there up on his you-know-what, is that they are going to make you think a lot when you are on the line of scrimmage. And one of the cliches I'm the most fond of, well, I'm sure there's a number of iterations of it, but specifically on the offensive line or really any positions, the more you're thinking, the less you're firing off the ball. And, you know, they have all sorts of different fronts and looks and running, you know, stunts where they're bringing two guys slanting, one guy coming all the way across. And this is a good Western offensive line. We've mentioned we've definitely seen better ones in recent years. They still have that monster in Eric Anderson who did his thing, but just maybe speak on how tough it can be, especially when, you know, and you brought up such an interesting point about, you know, for pretty much every other conference, that whole idea of when you kind of have to save something versus when you know you're probably going to face a team another. At this point, no matter what conference you're in, you're throwing caution to the wind and you're saying, let's let it rip. And when it comes to Montreal doing that, there's so many different things you're going to have to prepare for. It just becomes such a nightmare.
Most definitely. They are very comfortable bringing a ton of different blitzes and a ton of different fronts, regardless of the situation. And they're pretty good at everything they do on that front seven. Certainly you and I can kind of speak to experience from that. But this one was tough because typically when playing against some of the great pass rushers that we have in the OUA, like, you know, your Kalani Amusins, your Tyson Hergotts, your whoever, a lot of times they don't have it's not the same caliber of focus on pass rush from the defensive tackles. Not to say that the D tackles that they played with were bad, but they're more all-rounded rather than pure pass rushers in that regard. I think that this interior defense, the D-line for Montreal specifically, really is what made the difference here. Evan's shown in the past that he has an incredible ability to step up in the pocket, move around when he needs to, and make plays. He didn't have that in this game. He was getting pressured from all angles here, and the two fumbles that he did have were strip sacks where he got hit like almost blindsided, or the guys coming in there. And shout out to the Montreal defense, because just as bad as the Western offense seemingly had played, that defense for Montreal played really, really well, and they knew what they were doing. When they came in for those strip sacks, they were looking for the ball. They were hammering it out, creating those turnovers. So the Caravan really played fantastic on defense here. And Evan really did not have any, it didn't seem like he consistently had time to do anything here. Now, there's so many things that we saw that were just not typical of an Evan Hillock. You know, it didn't seem like the same thing. Now, you know, maybe there's an argument that he wasn't as pressured as often as he was here in the rest of the OUA, but I don't know. This was just a tough game. His final stats, 15 for 29, 212 yards, no touchdowns, 3 picks. And, you know, for a guy in Evan, where we expect the greatness, the excellence that he brings at every game here, this was just, you know, it wasn't that this was not anywhere near what we had thought we were going to see.
Yeah, I mean, and you mentioned the two strip sacks. I mean, I think it was the one by Harold Misen where, you know, kind of to that conversational piece on what Montreal brings to stifle your own schemes, where no doubt there was something unaccounted for because he just shot right off the edge. And, you know, given Evan's health concerns throughout the latter part of the season, which shouldn't be forgotten in this conversation, of course, or just in any consideration, you know, you had to take a beat and be like, man, I hope he's okay from that mm-hmm. one. And just as a point of comparison, if I don't know if this makes this situation worse, or maybe it just further validates the fact that we were, you know, the ones, not the only ones, but that we were, you know, championing that he didn't lose them the game against Laval last year. You just read off the stats in this game. You know, last year he goes 17 of 31 for 189, one touchdown, no interceptions. He didn't play great, but he didn't lose them this game. And I'm not saying he solely lost them this game, but he played poorly in this one versus not playing excellent as we normally see him. Which once again, when you're in national semifinals, when you're playing the Rouge or the Caravan, or pretty much, well, I was going to say the champion out of the RCQ, but it's going to be one of those two teams. Mm-hmm. It's going to have to be more than just your like C-plus game or B-minus game. And this one may have been a little bit lower than that. I don't know, Tom. Anything else? I mean, we obviously, you know, ate a bit of crow in the Yates when, even without, Yazbek, and without Edwards, they still had the running game going. You know, to their credit, Dolby gets 84, Thompson gets 53. You know, not Western rushing numbers as we normally expect, but still, this is your third and fourth string running back. Credit to them, no doubt, in that regard. Anything else you want to comment on with this one?
Yeah, I want to make sure that we are properly calling out Montreal here. While, you know, certainly Western, I think this is a very different game if Western is on point, and specifically their offense is producing like we know that they can. The fact is they didn't. And I think the main reason for that, quite honestly, is because of this Montreal defense. Now, once again, they finish the stats for this game, 47 total tackles, 5 sacks, 7 tackles for loss, 2 forced fumbles, 3 fumble recoveries, 3 interceptions, 2 pass breakups. That's a hell of a stat for this Montreal defense to hang their hats on. They played outstanding in this game, and a lot of the excellence that we saw was from that front 7 and constantly pressuring Evan, making sure that he's never comfortable in the pocket, sacking him 5 times. Like I mentioned, he got hit and he got pressured a whole lot more than that as well. And they obviously came with a solid game plan here, and they executed it really well and at a high level, you know? And I think a big, you know, something else to be of note here is that Montreal crowd showed up, and they packed that stadium, and it was pretty impressive. And, you know, they played really well. They played just really well. Jonathan Senecal, like I said, some of the throws that he was making were just unbelievable. Some of the things that he can do, he's definitely going to be somebody that you have to account for regardless of what you think can happen or what you think of Montreal. I think that he is the clear-cut Hec Crichton based off the performance that he's shown in the regular season, and obviously just kind of confirming that in this game here. But yeah, the Keter band really played well. They deserve this win.
No doubt. And I guess last thing I'll say as well is just the same thing about Senecal, where like the numbers don't jump off the page, but you could certainly see just how great he is just from the tools and everything like that. You know, their numbers don't drop off the page either, but you know, when you saw Carl Chabot and Dudley Jones with the ball in their hands, you're like, okay, I get why this team, that defense as you highlighted, is so spectacular. And you know, Senecal, one man wrecking crew, but then you can see, oh no, when he gets it to his guys, it's a special team. It's a very special team. You mentioned the crowd with that, Vanny, obviously being in Kingston, and you know, I'll probably say it again at least one more time. Tom and I will be live and direct from Kingston for the Vanier Cup, so come say what's up. But with it being so close to Montreal, you can bet your bottom dollar that they will travel very well. And perhaps coming off of you know, the conversation we had about the comments of Mr. Ducroix, Monsieur Ducroix, I should say, they might be coming in full force on that one. I guess we're saying bonne nuit à les Mustangs de Western. and to our OUA for the year, we'll put a more tidy bow on it, as you alluded to in the York comments, when we kind of get some time after the season wraps up and kind of think about what our off-season content will look like. But I guess, before we jump into the Mitchell, Tom, that's it for the OUA for the year. Any parting words for our dear sweet OUA?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it has been another just incredible year of OUA football. I think that every time we get a chance to talk about OUA, it's a good day for me. And this year really just did not disappoint. Through all of the incredible emergences from teams, through shocking downfalls from some others, and the Western fan base really letting us have it when we picked against them, it's always such an incredible year when you get that chance to talk about some fantastic football like we've been seeing in the OUA. Certainly not the result that I thought was going to happen in this one. I thought we were going to get back to the Vanier Cup and have some representation there. But anytime you make it out of the OUA, as you and I both know, there's some damn good teams across the country here that are vying for the exact same thing. And Montreal came away with this one. So we bid adieu to the OUA this year. But we are not saying goodbye to fantastic football because we're not done with that yet.
No, sir. And, you know, obviously now we're diving into the Mitchell, and it really does look like we have an incredible matchup on our hands in the Vanier. So before we get to there, because as we said, if you didn't read the title of this episode, we are going to set up the Vanier Cup following this breakdown. But we, of course, don't do that before talking about this Mitchell Bowl. We saw the UBC Thunderbirds taking out the Santa Fe Axemen 47-17. Obviously, for what it's worth, both home teams claiming victory, whereas last year we actually saw both road teams claiming victory on their way to the Vanier Cup, though of course it's now back-to-back RCQ versus Can West Vanier Cups. I'm not going to dissect all the feelings I might have about that, though I certainly have some feelings saying that, because I, much like yourself, thought we were going to have a team in the Vanier Cup this year. But my comment starts very much like you would set up in giving Garrett Rooker Offensive Player of the Week here, because what, I mean, we said how Senegal showed just through the talent and the skills and the tools, like, okay, I get it, he's great. Rooker came out here, he showed the skills, and then, you know, he put up the numbers to boot. I mean, it would, we've already talked about him, but now that we're diving into this game, it would be wrong to do anything, I think, then start with the performance by Mr. Rooker.
Yeah, absolutely. We already said the stats, but I'll go through it again because they're just fantastic. 22 of 26, 303 yards, 4 total touchdowns. You know, he really just played outstanding here. And I think while we are going to, obviously, we did give him the Offensive Player of the Week, I do want to give a shout out to Sam Davenport as well, receiver for them. 8 catches, 139 yards, and 2 touchdowns. It's a hell of a game that he had in this one, but you know, this offense really seemed to be clicking here. It was impressive to really watch. Isaiah Knight running back for them as well. 17 attempts, 115 yards on the ground. You know, they really seemed to be able to impose their will against what I thought was a very good Santa Fe defense, and just kind of showcased the power of the Can West and why they're going back. The Can West, anyways, is going back for a second year to the Vanier.
Yeah, and you know what's it's interesting where we see now, we talk about the parallels of last year in terms of Can West and an RCQ team facing off. And though we have different representatives from those conferences, the teams that were defeated are the same in both, obviously, Western and St. FX. And we did the comparison with Evan Hillock in terms of just that performance he had at home versus Laval, and in a very valiant effort, or a much more valiant effort in defeat last year than perhaps it was this year. And though I know you and I both love his game, I do kind of feel the same about Silas, that you know, I don't have the numbers in front of me from last year in that home game against Saskatchewan, but you know, it very much, you know, as I don't tune into as many of his games, we've seen the talent. You know, there's enough buzz about him to know that, you know, he's no joke, but it does leave me a little cold from what we saw him do against Saskatchewan last year, in that near massive upset, and then in this one, obviously going 16 of 31 for 195, no touchdowns and 3 interceptions. It's disappointing. It goes back to that first comment that we made, where it's like, as far as a full weekend of Canadian football, the Grey Cup really saved us all in terms of our viewing. And I don't mean that to come off as overly pouring it on to Silas, but just as saying that we've obviously seen him in a high leverage game, literally almost in this very same type of game, play much better. And you know, I don't know whether to chalk it up as UBC just being at home, the travel, comparing their defense to what Saskatchewan's defense was last year, because that Saskatchewan team was legit too. But you know, just kind of part and parcel of this whole conversation that both these games were kind of a letdown, which, as the super last thing I'll say, allowed for more time for you and I to just hang out, though. So that was a pleasure as well.
Yes, it was a fantastic time over at the Bader Shammai household, and I do appreciate you having me over there once again. I was also treated, for those of you who don't know, our one and only Zach here is a hell of a cook as well. Had some fantastic stew and some outstanding banana oat bread, whatever you want to call that. It was fantastic. So thank you once again for everything that you did for me.
Anytime, brother.
But yeah, like you said, in the year before, they play in the UTEC Bowl against the Huskies out in Antigonish. 17 for 36, 258 yards and 2 touchdowns in that game. Comparing to 16 for 31, 195, and 3 interceptions here. Now, I do think it is worth noting that watching the AUS last year and into the regular season, this was a big step away from what their standard game plan had been. Malcolm Bussey on the broadcast. So let's go with our guys. Malcolm Bussey came out and was the AUS MVP last year, and he was showcasing the amazing stuff that he was doing on the ground, and that's what a lot of what we expected. And then against the Huskies, they came out throwing, and Silas looked great, and Ben Harrington was off the charts and all of this. And I think that mystique has gone away because Silas was the AUS MVP this year, and they opened with the pass, and that was their real focus here. And so UBC knew what to expect. Now, obviously, anytime you have something like that, and Ben Harrington, while maybe not necessarily being his number one receiver target this year, is still a hell of a receiver, a hell of a player, and to have him go down and be out after just one catch, yeah, that's a big loss to the offense. And Zachary Hood, number 82 for them, 8 catches, 107 yards. He was very clearly the go-to, but there was a lot of times where it seemed like Silas was just forcing it, trying to get to him. And it didn't come across to me that either Silas had a lot of faith in the rest of his receiving core, or that the plays that had been called up were called for everybody as well. It would, like, Silas caught the ball in a lot of plays, stared at number 82, and then threw it a lot of times, regardless of what the coverage was. And now, obviously, Zach does come down with 8 catches here, but I would be interested to see how many times he was actually targeted, because I think a few of those interceptions were because he had tried to be, you know, forcing it into him there. So that's something that I wanted to make sure that I brought up here and just kind of discuss at the very least.
No, 1,000%. I mean, obviously, that's going to stifle, you know, pretty much every aspect of the team's of their offense when Harrington goes down, everything like that, and the run game being so focal for them with Bussey, it kind of felt like the whole thing was kind of, you know, in mud a little bit. It just, you know, it felt like, and not to take away from UBC and not to take a shot at St. FX, though, it feels like I almost have to be doing one or the other, I guess. But it didn't feel like, in comparison to Western, feeling like they were really getting challenged by Montreal and getting those mistakes forced upon them in certain regards. And maybe this is part of the travel piece to it. It just felt at times like they were just looking a little sluggish. And I'm not sure if that was just a bad reading of it by me, and maybe I'm not giving UBC enough credit. But, you know, when we talked about Rooker in terms of just the offensive player of the week perspective, and, you know, if you took the logos off the field and you're just watching the way that he's operating this offense, it very much looks like a pro setup, which, when we get our, like, when we tune in for, you know, the Hardy Cup and for the whichever bowl game that Can West is playing in, because of how much more they tend to seem to pass the ball than our OUA teams of recent years, and also because of Can West feeds, and maybe we'll talk about we need to talk about actually how we had to view this game briefly. We haven't got to that. We should have, my bad. But when we talk about, you know, you take the logos off and you're like, this feels very professional in some regards, in large part when it comes to UBC, that's the factor of the 2 tackles on this team in Theo Benedet and Giovanni Manu, And you were enlightening me to some very interesting news that you had heard. And I don't know if this is breaking news for people who maybe follow the other conferences more so. But, I mean, these dudes are like mammoths of human beings, and they move well. They look, you know, we talk about some of our Goliaths that we have in the OE way. These dudes are pro ready, and it might not just be CFL pro ready we're talking when it comes to these two guys. Am I remembering that correctly?
You are remembering that correctly, sir. Both of these tackles have garnered some serious NFL buzz. They are outstanding individuals, outstanding young men. I believe both of them are either 6'6 or 6'7, over 310 pounds, and they move incredibly well. So having two anchors like that on either side of you here, you can see why Garrett Rooker has seen all of the success that he's had, because he's actually able to just sit back there and throw the ball rather than constantly running for his life like some other quarterbacks that we saw. So yeah, most definitely, those guys are the real deal. They'll certainly be high CFL draft picks, depending on what happens with the NFL, obviously. But they are two studs of offensive linemen here that every team that they played against has obviously recognized that. But Montreal is definitely going to have to account for.
Yeah. And, you know, talking about just the pro aspect of things here, and because, frankly, I don't have a heck of a lot all that interesting to say about just the game in itself. Like, it was unfortunately pretty one-sided from relatively early on. But going back to Rooker again, because I believe he's in his third year eligibility, do we know, and when I say we, of course I mean you, Tom, is he a possible nationalized player? Like, has he spent enough of his time? Because we obviously, I think we were so excited seeing one Sean Lall, though, of course, in street clothes, having just transferred from Guelph this past year, as perhaps the man to fill the shoes for Rooker. Is, do you know what his situation is in terms of where he may be playing in 2024?
As far as I saw it, and I believe this is what I had saw, Garrett Rooker, third year of eligibility. So, I know that it's oftentimes it's very common for folks out in the Can West to play in the CJFL. And I believe Garrett Rooker is actually an American, so I don't know how much that time also affected that. Because I know in the CJFL, that can sometimes affect your eligibility, or at the very least, like we had said previously, you have to use your 5 years of eligibility within 7 years of graduating high school. So I don't know for sure what the case is for Rooker, but on the official website, it does say that he's in his third year of eligibility, meaning that he could potentially have two more years at UBC.
Well, you know, selfishly, for our guy, Sean Lall, I certainly hope he's out of there soon, because obviously Lall spent a few years in Guelph, so he's just getting up there in age in general as well. And, you know, despite what the current decision makers at Guelph, I guess, I've come to believe about him, he is supremely talented. So just, you know, and once again, all of this, everything happening at UBC, of course, under the vision of Blake Nill, and you know you're in good hands. And, you know, obviously it's interesting to think about Rooker and the talent he has, and they were highlighting on the broadcast, and obviously Mark Lee and our guy Deshaun Stevens did a phenomenal job, though I do want to talk about the broadcasts a little bit. Mentioning that the last bowl game that UBC was in was ironically on their way to a Vanier Cup against Montreal, math, 8 years ago, with one Michael O'Connor at quarterback for them, who obviously we know went on to have a good career. So I guess the lesson pretty simply is get a CFL caliber quarterback in your program and you'll do all right. And that might be what we're seeing in this Vanier Cup between Senecal and Rooker, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's certainly a hot take to say that when you have a CFL caliber quarterback in a Vanier Cup, that's a recipe for success here. But yeah, certainly I think that it's no coincidence that when UBC has had some phenomenal quarterback play, they've gone back to the Vanier Cup here. And I think something similar for obviously Montreal as well. There's a lot of similarities between the two teams. But yeah, UBC certainly seems to be trained for a hell of a matchup here in this one. Like you said, there really wasn't a ton to talk about, unfortunately, on the SATFX side of things. I was hoping for a lot more. I was hoping that SATFX was finally going to help the AUS get over the hump and get back into the Vanier Cup, but not this year, and the streak continues, unfortunately, for the AUS. But I don't, like, UBC 100% deserves this. They just played outstanding in this game, and I cannot wait for a Vanier Cup that, like you said, you and I will both be in attendance for.
Most certainly, and I'm very happy that we'll be there for so many reasons. One, just as a celebration of Canadian football, the 58th Vanier Cup, as it is. An opportunity for me to spend more time with my good friend, that being you, of course, Tom Sterling, to see these two teams that we've just talked about, and we'll talk about a bit in comparison now in setting up this game. But also, because, and I apologize for looking away when you were just talking there, I was trying to see what the broadcasting status is for this game, because when you initially came down to Toronto, it was under the guise that, you know what, and I'd called a couple spots, and when I told them that, you know, it was going to be on CBC, I was told that, hey, no problem, we can hook that up, it's on cable, we can get that on the TV, and we were thinking we were going to be sitting in a bar, having a few pops and watching it there, which I wouldn't have traded in the experience, viewing experience we had for any bar in the world. But of course, we had misread the broadcasting situation in that it wasn't on CBC television proper, or however you want to frame it, but it was a streaming service on their website. Now, in some regards, I can understand it would make it more accessible. You know, a lot of people cut the cord, move away from cable. Most people, like, this obviously makes it so if you just have a smartphone, you can, and some internet or some data you're willing to splurge on, you can go ahead and watch it. And I can understand that, and maybe, I don't know, it was certainly a little disappointing when, not that I am unfamiliar with tuning into my U Sports football through a computer screen, that for the national semifinal that we were still doing it, and some other aspects of the broadcast that you had sort of illuminated me to, despite as good a job that Lee and Stevens did, and I don't remember the gentleman in the other game as well, but yeah, let's just talk about that a little bit before we dive into the Vanier.
Yeah. You and I have been talking about so often getting back to the glory days of U Sports football, which is really just one game broadcasted a week and then covering properly the conference championships and obviously the national championship on TV. The days of The Score and Tim McAuliffe are long gone, and we are just clamoring for that to come back, because it just gives... Not only does it give some more legitimacy to the game itself, but suddenly you expose an entire generation of people to some phenomenal football, whether they be young, old, or in between. The amount of people that have said, oh my gosh, like, I remember where I was to watch the 09 Vanier Cup, or I remember where I was with the 2011 Vanier, or all of these things to me, and how it influenced them and where they wanted to go. And, you know, like I've said before, Asher Hastings, U Sports record holder for most touchdown passes in a regular season, came to McMaster because he saw us on TV and thought things were pretty cool there. So the recruiting that's there, the influence that it has on the community as well, in order to bring up the game of football in general, I really think that there's so much that goes into something along those lines. And good God, am I hoping to get back to that in this regard. But, you know, even some of the broadcast, the quality of the streams here at certain times were lackluster. Now, What I will say is that the commentators that we had for this were fantastic. Mark Lee and Deshaun are always at the top of their games anytime they're calling anything, and it's always a pleasure to listen to the two of them. Mo Khan and Andrew Bartlett as well, for the UTEC. They did a great job. I really enjoyed everything that I saw there, but I am still so hopeful to get back to the glory days of U-Sports and getting back onto the national stage and hopefully having somebody like a TSN pick things up and go from there. But that's my spiel.
Well, and it's a good spiel. You mentioned the Asher Hastings story. I always remember Chris Ozikusi saying a similar story, being from Brampton and seeing the tricolors of the Queens Golden Gales and being like, hey, you know what? Kind of want to take my talents there. And, you know, what was funny is that, I mean, with it being the online stream, there was, I think you didn't need even all the fingers on one hand to count the number of ads that ran through during commercial breaks, and one of them was a U Sport ad that sort of centered around a young child watching two laptops simultaneously, and it left me cold. It's you know, and maybe I'm just showing my age where I'm just like, oh, no, that's not how you tune in. And then on the one hand, maybe as a U Sports rep or delegate, you're saying, but look at it. This child's able to watch two games at the same time. And you know what? If one of those is, say, a U Sport football game, while the other one, or like, yeah, a football game, and the other one is, say, women's soccer at the same time, right? Totally cool. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if they're still trying to sell, though, that, like, hey, he can tune in to watch Western at Mac and the Battle of Waterloo. Well, that goes back to our whole piece on, well, just learn how to stagger your schedules then, and maybe that'll fix the problem that he's not having to watch two games at once. We'll put that one to bed. Let's talk, though. We got the 58th Vanier Cup a near 4 days away now at the time of recording. It's Montreal, it's UBC, it's a rematch, as we said, from 8 years ago. Montreal, of course, taking yours truly out and my Guelph Griffins on their way to said matchup, where they were then dethroned. And I say dethroned because they were the reigning champs after taking out
me truly
taking out Tom Sterling as McMaster Marauders in 2014. Let's get into this. On the surface, from the two national semis that we had, one can see this as the defensive juggernaut that is the Montreal Caravan taking on this offensive powerhouse in the UBC Thunderbirds. But as we said, Jonathan Senecal, he showed everything that he can do, just didn't execute it against the defense in the Western Mustangs. And so I guess I'll start off like this, comparing UBC's defense to what Western can do and thinking about what Rooker was able to do against St. FX versus thinking about what he might be able to do against Montreal's defense, which is, a cut above where St. FX is at. When it's all said and done, from what you've been able to discern from these two defenses, I guess, where do you see, like, something's kind of got to give in that formula? Because as much as we talked about, this is two CFL, likely future CFL draft picks, I would like to hope, if anything, duking it out on the center stage of all Canadian football, the Grey Cup is done after all. Where do these defenses play a role in terms of perhaps slowing them down? Or will we get perhaps a shootout, which would certainly be such a spectacular sight to see?
I really think that this has the potential to be a shootout here. I think that I really like everything that I've seen from Garrett Rooker in the few games that I have been able to watch of his. Now, to be fair, I don't think that he's played a defense like this Montreal Caravan defense is going to give him. I think this Montreal defense from head to toe is damn good. I don't really see a weakness anywhere there. Certainly their pass rushes there, the linebackers that have been playing were just outstanding in the games that I've seen. And obviously in the secondary, they did their thing against Evan Hillock in this past game here. But I like the confidence that Garrett Rooker has. And I like the fact that he's been painted into corners in the CanWest regular season as well, and been able to come out a lot of the times on top for those. Sam Davenport and him obviously have such an amazing connection in that regard. And I think they're going to be able to do some really great things here. On the other side of things, I don't think this UBC defense has seen somebody like a Jonathan Senecal. And I don't think, you know, Jonathan Senecal is a kind of a generational talent like a Trey Ford. And I don't think the league had seen anybody like Trey Ford for a very long time. It's certainly in his 5-year window when he was with the Waterloo Warriors here. The big difference in this one is that, you know, I know that we've got a lot of Waterloo listeners here, but Senecal has the pieces around him as well. He doesn't have to do everything on his own, even though that oftentimes he does. He's the big focal point here, but he's got the receivers. He's got the blocking for it. Like he really has the potential to do a lot of really great things here. Going up and watching these two teams and their defenses in UBC and in Western, I would still give the edge defensively to the Western Mustangs in this one. Not anything against the UBC in this, but I think that Western's defense was just really great and had been, you know, a little bit more tailored to something along those lines. So I think UBC, certainly to begin with, is going to struggle at trying to contain Jonathan Senecal if they can at all. But I think, and I hope to God, that we see a shootout and an exciting game in this one here. However, if you were to look at in terms of percentages, in terms of who do I think has the greater possibility of having that, I would think that the Montreal offense has a larger possibility of really scoring a lot of points here rather than UBC. Not to say that I don't think UBC will. I think it's kind of like an 80% versus like a 79% kind of thing. But yeah, both of these squads here are pretty damn good.
No doubt, and why I'm so excited to have this matchup and to be there. Obviously, I'll admit, I am a stranger to both these clubs, but having to have put them on my radar in the last few weeks with Montreal, and this goes to the point of that generational talent piece about John Senecal, where you look at just this team's production and just what they like, seemingly what they lack in any form of a rushing attack. And on the flip side, you can look at UBC and saying, like, they got this guy in Isaiah Knight, who, you know, whatever we thought of Santa Fe's defense, was looking really sharp in that whole piece on, you know, him getting a playoff of what Rooker can do and everything like that. And so I'm almost like, I almost feel like I'm wanting to be quick on the trigger, so to speak, of saying, like, if you're UBC, and, you know, easier said than done, because no doubt teams in the RSCQ have been saying this all year long, like, let Montreal get whatever they want on the ground, slow down Senecal by all means necessary. But the question kind of becomes, and this goes back to why I'd be so fascinated to talk with someone from Western as far as the game plan, where, like, what do you, like, how do you slow down? And I know both of us made our marks on the offensive side of the ball. But when you slow down someone like this, and we watched Trey Ford for 4 years in the OUA and are so privileged to get to continue to watch him now for the Elks, when you say, well, okay, if you're committing, like when you traditionally think of maybe slowing down someone who is just like an elite passer, like you're facing a team where, say, they are so heavy into the pass and can't run, maybe you're going to say, hey, we're playing three up front, and we're going to drop back, you know, darn near everyone else. Maybe we'll do a little zone blitz to just throw off the reads and something like this. But we are gonna blanket the whole field so they do not have space. Well, we've seen he moves so well. Okay, great. So then maybe you say, well, we need to add a contain component to this. Or maybe we have to have a spy component to this. Well, all of a sudden, like it's just because he can do so many things, there's no way to just have a kind of generic way of saying that it's the passing game. Like, it is an elite singular player. And as we said, he's got his guy in Carl Chabot, who is so formidable when he gets the ball in his hand, and in his guy in Dudley and everything like this. So I'm so curious now on this major of a stage to see, what will UBC do? Are they going to try and say, bring some of that pressure that Western tried to do, which seemingly was effective? Will they try and sit back? Will they try and, you know, drop a guy, bring someone from another space. Like, once again, we're more offensive guys, but maybe that trade comparison allows us to think about this a little with a little more familiarity. Even if you're going to say we won't even care about the run, you have to go more in depth than that to slow down someone like this.
Yeah, you have to attack this defense, or excuse me, this offense, as if they have a balanced attack, even if it's just Jonathan Senekal, because he can do it all. And, you know, there have been times where we've seen that spy aspect that other teams are bringing when they play against them. The issue is, a lot of times, even if a team has a spy, Senekal is fast enough to get around them and still get some serious yardage before they're able to do anything, which is why I think, exactly like you said earlier in the podcast, the idea of, okay, if Senekal rushes out to your side in a zone defense, automatic half fire, automatic, you're blitzing him, you're going after him, you're trying to do something. But that means that you need a defensive shift in order to take over, because it's the easiest thing in the world for a quarterback, especially like Senekal, who has seen this and that's his play style, to see somebody come up and rush him and just do a little floater right over top of their head into the hands of his receivers down the field here. So your entire defense needs to change to understand the threat that you're going against here. And obviously, in a perfect world, your pass rush is so elite that you just keep him contained in the pocket and you take away his ability to run. But with the phenomenal play that we've seen from him, and quite honestly, while yes, we acknowledge the fact that Western did not have a really solid pass rush, that Montreal offensive line played really well, and they stonewalled a few stud Western defenders that we've seen over this past year do their thing. I don't think that it's realistic to say that UBC is just going to contain him outright and he's not going to have any opportunities to get out there and run. So you have to make sure that you're taking that into effect. Your defense has to change dramatically, because this is the only time that you've really played a quarterback like this. You know, they may have played, better individual passers or somebody who likes to run a little bit more often or whatever, but this dude is the full package here, and he can torch you on any given play.
And, you know, it's funny, that whole idea of sending that pressure to where he goes, and yeah, then that leaves a vacancy. But I'm now just thinking of, I forget who it was on Montreal that had the Kashuk-esque interception when Evan tried to throw it over those hands. And yeah, once again, you know, it's the classic, you know, anytime you're bringing pressure, anytime you're going to, you know, make one of those, you know, gambles, if you will, there's the high risk, high reward probability of it. And, you know, I'll admit again, I'm out of my waters in talking about this team and about this kid in specific. But with, you know, I do think that Western did show a little bit that, you know, while he can move, there were times where I just felt maybe, even though he can make those off platform throws, and maybe they're gonna watch the film and they're gonna make their corrections, because obviously it wasn't a stellar game offensively for them nonetheless. Against Western, that is, where I still think he could have done a bit more to settle down. But maybe if he feels like all that pressure is coming, once again, maybe that's that uncomfortability factor that's coming into the fold. But certainly one of the differences we can say about him and Hillock is just the, you know, ability to get out of the pocket, though, as you've highlighted so well, how Evan can navigate the pocket. Once he's truly outside, he doesn't seem like he can make those throws as Senekal can, but maybe those comments we were making about every now and then him still not settling his feet when it felt like he could, maybe that's a little bit of the footsteps of this Western defense coming to attack them. Obviously, you were so right in sort of slowing down or redirecting our conversation from the UTEC as far as being, as far as crediting what that Montreal defense did to Western versus thinking about just blankly that Western had a poor game. Both those things can be true, as often is the case. So let's talk about this side of it, right? Where we have Rooker coming off of this magnificent performance. We have Isaiah Knight, a much more balanced attack for them offensively. Montreal, we could say that, you know, they were bringing in some of these exotic looks, showing a bunch of different fronts, different pressures, things like this, the twists, all these types of things. In some ways, though, the numbers don't bear it out. And, you know, if we had gotten Western versus UBC, I'm sure that would be a brilliant game to watch as well. Based on just the health of both these teams, this does feel like a more well-rounded offense that they're going up against. Just because, I mean, if Yazbek and Edwards is are in that game, and if Hillock's at full strength, it's a much different story. Do you think that component will change Montreal's approach to taking on this team? Or do you think that what they showed against Western is more a reflection of just the team they try to be? Do they kind of play that, you know, do you take them to be more of that team of like, no, we do what we do really, really well, and you have to beat us. We're not going to necessarily think that we have to beat you on every single level. Not to say that they're not game planning, but more of that, well, frankly, that kind of Western-esque kind of bravado of like, you know our plays, but we're pretty darn good at it. Where do you see it against UBC with a more well-rounded offense that, compared to at least their last opponent, is a lot, seemingly a lot healthier with those two Goliaths on the O-line we talked about?
Yeah, you know, it's something interesting because I don't think you and I could possibly say at any given point that that Western offense played their game. I think the entire time that Montreal defense dominated and forced them into their tempo, forced the Mustangs into that Montreal style, or at least the way that they were defending in that regard. I think that that's the goal, obviously, again this week, in trying to obviously take away a lot of the things that UBC does well, but to ultimately make sure that UBC is forced to play Montreal Catterband football rather than Thunderbird football. I am really interested to see in this style, in this offense that UBC has to bring against this Montreal defense, because something you brought up as well, and I love that you did, is the fact that the RSEQ this year did not have a very serious running attack at all. When you look at the stats here, the highest rusher out of the RSEQ was Frank Dikembe from Concordia with 529 yards. Underneath him, and Frank is ranked 13th in all of U Sports with that yardage there. Cicerello from McGill at 493 yards at number 15. And then at 23 is one Jonathan Senecal with 394 yards. So they really have not seen a prominent runner in the RSEQ this year compared to Isaiah Knight at number 6 in U Sports with 787 total yards here and 5 touchdowns. I think that if I'm UBC going into this, I'm thinking, you know what? Let's really see what this run defense is all about. Let's see if they are the real deal. We've obviously seen the incredible efforts and the incredible things that they're able to do when they're up against the pass. Let's put these two big boys on either side of the ball here, on either side of our offensive line, to work. And let's see what you can do to stop Isaiah Knight in this run game here. My attempt is to run it down Montreal's throat and force them to stop it before relying on my all-star quarterback and Garrett Rooker to go through the air and start doing his thing here. I think more than anything for UBC, I think that's your opportunity here where the run needs to set up the pass. You need to make sure that Montreal defense stays honest and they're not blitzing and doing those things. You know, you and I both know it is very difficult, especially when you have proper technique and proper rules in your run game. For a defense, it's very difficult to properly twist into a run. It's very difficult to blitz into a run when you're picking that up, and then suddenly your levels to your defense are gone, and Isaiah Knight makes one guy miss, and suddenly he's down the field for 15 yards before he makes contact with another person. So you start really showcasing some prominent abilities in the run game, and you start dominating on the ground here. Suddenly Montreal has to go back to a more basic defense. They have to respect the run, and that means that they're not able to tee off like we saw against the Western Mustangs. So I really think that that has to be the game plan for UBC. Rely on your run game, rely on Isaiah Knight and the amazing stuff that he has done, and force Montreal to respect you in both the run and in the pass, so you can set up Garrett Rooker, Sam Davenport in that potent passing attack without having three or four Carabin in your face trying to throw the ball.
Yeah, you know, it's a strong point, and I recall some of the things that we were talking about coming off the Yates, where Laurier would do some zone blitzing where they're dropping that DN that's covering Anderson as a way of kind of being like, hey, look, like we're probably unlikely to beat him on a one-on-one. Not that they did that every single time, but just as a little wrinkle of saying like, hey, let's at least take him out of the play by saying you're not effective if you're not blocking one. Send more pressure to another side. You can't really play that if you have two Eric Anderson-esque guys on your tackles, which then makes me wonder, as you're saying, can UBC force Montreal into something a little more base as a result of that run game? Or is Montreal from the jump going to say, you know what, if this O-line is as spectacular as they've shown to be this year, and just with the two just like outliers of talent they have at tackle, do they just say a little bit more, let's try things a little more straight up, or at least maybe instead of all that twisting and things of that nature, maybe they're bringing I don't know. I'm very curious, because I think either way, whether they recognize the disadvantage they might have of trying to take on those tackles that they have at UBC, or as a product of, as you mentioned, maybe getting gashed in the run game, I think they could just do something a little more base. And of course, when we talk about, you know, Isaiah Knight, it's still just, we think about, it's all, you know, the cross-conference comparisons are tough, especially as OUA guys that much more. But, you know, it's not just a situation where, you know, in the AUS, we look at Malcolm Bussey and just how great he's been over the last couple of years. But it's like out of Can West, we still have a guy like Matthew Peterson, right, who's had such a phenomenal year for Alberta and everything like that. So as much as, you know, we love to talk about that commentary of the kind of pro-style nature of how they throw the ball as well, like, they're running the ball with the best of these leagues as well. I mean, we saw it with Laval last year when, Arnaud Desjardins obviously being such a phenomenal player, and Kevin Mitall and everything like that. But then when it came down to it, they were running the ball with the best of them as well. Obviously, what Riker Frank was doing at Saskatchewan. These teams that get to this level seemingly are all like so well-rounded, and UBC is as much of that as anything. But then I keep going back to, but hold on, there's this kid in blue playing in this game, or at least a lighter blue, because it's the navies versus the I don't know, more of a sky blue, with Senecal. And that Greg Marshall quote still, it permeates my dreams that you read out, that Deshaun at Persevere had shared of him, you know, making that Trey Ford comparison. And so, like, I'm really stuck between thinking of, it really feels like a battle of, well, obviously defensively, you probably give the nod, or no, you certainly give the nod to Montreal, or maybe not certainly, but I think the nod is to Montreal. And then offensively, I'm so inclined to say that just from what we've been seeing, that UBC looks like they are the pick on this one as far as that well-rounded collective, but then that X factor for Montreal makes it certainly hard. Tom, what other angles are you thinking about on this one? I mean, we can think about obviously our guy in Kieran Flannery-Fleck. I haven't checked the weather for the game in Kingston. Philippe Boyer. Boyer looked pretty solid for Montreal, from whether we want to check out the kicking angle of this from a return standpoint. Obviously, we talked about Dudley Jones as just that receiving threat along with Chabot for Montreal as well, and just what he can do for them. We obviously can look at a guy in McBean and what he's doing for UBC. Where are the other angles on this one? Because I'm, you know, obviously this, you know, out of my waters. What else are you seeing on this?
Well, because you brought up the weather, supposed to be 3 degrees, very nice, sunny with a little bit of clouds, but you and I both know that wind that can come off the water in Kingston is definitely going to be a factor in this one. Right now, calling for 18 kilometer an hour winds. So The thing, and I don't know if you felt the same thing, but sometimes playing in Kingston, especially at that old stadium, that wind just seemed to swirl around. One quarter, it might have been going east to west. The next quarter, it's going north, south, or even west to east. And so that's definitely going to be a factor in this one, and I think that's going to be going into it as well. You mentioned it a little bit as well, but UBC, obviously, big travel for them. However, they're used to that. They had to play against Manitoba in Manitoba, and that's just an extra province away going back to Ontario for this one. But Montreal to Quebec anyways, what is that, 2 hours from Kingston? Less? More? Something along those lines? Yeah. The RSEQ faithful are going to travel. This is going to look like a Montreal home game, certainly in this one. And I really do think that that's going to factor into this as well. Not having played against the RSEQ, at least for a number of years here for this UBC team, I don't think that they're aware of how well that this Montreal or this, RSEQ fan base can travel and how much they love their teams out here. So I think that Montreal is going to see some considerable fans in this Kingston game. And I think UBC, while having certainly some, they are not going to be able to rely on the crowd in this one. I really do think that, once again, you've kind of mentioned it before, and we've talked about how incredibly important special teams is going to be in this one here. I think Kieran Flannery Fleck is going to do some good things, and I do think that we are going to see something from the special teams as well into this one. It's not just going to be an offensive or defensive focused game here, but when I look over and I see these two teams here, you see Philip Boyer and all of the stuff that he's been able to do this season, kicker for Montreal, and Carl Chabot, the unbelievable abilities that he has as well. I really like the matchup here. I think these are two incredibly well-rounded teams for the most part. I think if you're really looking at the offense, it's safer to say that UBC is going to see a little bit more success, because all you have to do on paper is shut down Jonathan Senecal, and suddenly that's their offense right there. But somehow, some way, no team that has faced against Montreal has been able to do that. So this is going to be a hell of a game. I really think that this is going to be the most exciting game. I think it's going to be more exciting than what the Grey Cup was, quite honestly, here. And I hope that as many people as possible get a chance to watch this one, because I really do think it's going to be a good one.
That sounds like we're at pick time then, Tom. Yeah.
Most definitely.
Oh, my goodness. Hey, what to do. It feels like it's, you know, with everything that we talked about with the Alouettes, the beautiful quote from Ducroix, the travel piece, and with the possible second coming of a Trey Ford, I'm thinking it's the year of the fleur-de-lis. As much as it pains me having fallen to this team and knowing that you, my brother, have fallen to them twice, or pardon me, to them one time, but to the RSEQ, I think we're rolling with La Belle Provence encore dans cette jour. Let's go Montreal over UBC. Let's throw out a score too, 30-28 on the final. We'll call it a close one. Not quite the offensive showdown that maybe we would hope for, but you know, within a field goal's reach, maybe it's the field goal winning it. I'm going Caravan in this one, Tom.
You know, it's something that I've kind of been constantly going back and forth on, taking a look at the amazing squads that both of these teams have. Garrett Rooker and Isaiah Knight, I really think, are the real deal. Jonathan Senecal, it's been a while since I've been watching a U Sports football game and gone, oh my God, like an actual jaw open watching somebody play. And I think that's exactly what this young man can do here. Through all of the different opportunities that they have on offense, through the incredible, amazing things that I've seen on defense here. And I thought that I'd be rolling over in my grave before I ever picked a Quebec team to win the Vanier Cup. But it's just, I really can't ignore the incredible play that I've seen from Montreal and the Carabin here, I think it's going to be Montreal taking this one and completing the Canadian football sweep and bringing the Vanier and the Grey Cup. And my God, would it be cool to see a Montreal parade for both of these squads if that were to happen.
That's actually, yeah, that's a really cool notion. What happened in the Canada Cup this year? We should dive into that. Maybe that's the Triple Crown, depending on what happened this past summer. Maybe we'll have some information to talk about that come the recap of it. Tom, here we are, my friend. Once again, me and Tom will be there in Kingston for the game. We're getting we'll coordinate just exactly like when we'll be there and everything like that. Knowing the fine people of Kingston and Queens, I'm sure they'll put on a show, so no doubt we'll want to be there a bit early to kind of take in the festivities of it all. Hit us up, or more specifically hit Tom up, because he's going to be the one seeing anything you share with us as far as if you're there. And as always, just if we got anything wrong or whatever your takes are, it's always appreciative. Just know you're out there listening and supporting. It really means the world to us. And just as always, thank you for consuming our content. So here we are, Tom. It is at the pinnacle. It is Vanier Cup 58, the Carabin, the Thunderbirds. It's set to be a classic, as you highlighted. And man, last words to you just on anything and everything before we hit the 401 East for Kingston.
Yeah, this is what U Sports, this is what this entire season has kind of been building up to in this penultimate game. I really cannot wait to see everything here. I cannot wait to be back at a Vanier Cup. They're always such an incredible experience here. The last one that I went to was in Tim Hortons Field that Western got a chance to play in, and it's such a celebration of Canadian football, especially at the university level here. I really hope that the entirety of Kingston comes out for this event, whether they're going to the game or not, to just kind of take in the sights and the sounds. I think this is going to be a hell of an atmosphere. It's going to be a hell of a time. And like you said, we will be in attendance. So if you've ever thought, hey, you know what? I've got some beef with these At the 55 guys. It'll be your chance. Please come on down to Kingston, catch a game. Going to be a great one. Can't wait.
Most certainly, and hey, at the very least, Kingston, you better have those French signs up for the Coupe de Vanier. S'il vous plaît, mes amis. Hey, anyways, it's been a privilege. It's been a pleasure. So if you see us in Kingston, say what's up. And if not, you'll listen to us later on this week, breaking it all down. Have a good bye.